Hello, I'm Leon Daniels, and I'm your host for Lunch with Leon, a weekly podcast series in which I hope to bring interesting people with interesting transport stories from around the world. My guest today is Guillaume Flirty, who is Managing Director and Head of Infrastructure, Transport and Manufacturing and Europe at Lloyds Bank. Lloyds Bank is a commercial partner with ITT Hub, the new exhibition event for vehicle manufacturers, data handlers, disruptors and energy providers, which will take place in Farnborough next year. We found time to have lunch as we prepared for the Future Logistics Conference being produced by another of our ITT Hub partners, Logistics UK.
So look, we're delighted to have Lloyds as a corporate sponsor at ITT Hub, and I can see that this whole move to zero emission is a really good stimulus for business. But is it good for the UK, Guillaume?
Well, I guess it is good for the UK. It can only be good for the UK because, you know, we are going there. Whether to be honest, we like it or not, I think every country will have to go there sooner or later. And you know what? I'd rather be at the forefront. And to be honest, that's what the UK has been doing so far. And we are trying to do our best to support that transition as a bank that is focused on, you know, was focused on help Britain prosper and is probably going to be now more focused on help Britain recover.
I mean, terrible times. I mean, I see the Bank of England talking to the banks about negative interest rates and the consequences for that. I mean, this is all uncharted territory for us, isn't it?
It is, and somehow that's what makes it very exciting, but at the same time also, you know, very scary. And interestingly, what you see when you talk to the different teams across Lloyds Bank and in particular in Commercial Bank, you know, there's probably a sense of purpose that we see with our colleagues that we probably didn't see for a number of years. Clearly, you know, the financial crisis of 2008 was difficult for the banks, and that was therefore difficult for us as well, Lloyds Bank. Today, this year, 2020, I think we concretely see the support, you know, we provide to our clients, the help we, you know, bring concretely to the UK economy, and therefore I would say the role and the key role that banks, not only Lloyds, but, you know, banks in general are bringing to the economy. So that makes it scary, interesting, exciting, but actually a sense of usefulness that we probably didn't have for a number of years as a banker.
Yes, interesting. And when I think we've all got the financial crisis from 2007, 2008 still fresh in our minds, haven't we? And I think we didn't know quite how close we were getting to being in some serious trouble. And I think that was definitely a bit of a wake-up call, wasn't it, for the banking sector?
Yeah, and I think, and hopefully banks and Lloyds in particular, you know, has been learning its lessons, because a lot of banks, you know, had to learn something out of it. And I guess, you know, for us, what that meant was relatively simple. You know, we've been very, very focused on helping Britain prosper. We redefine, you know, our strategy. And our strategy has been to help, you know, what people need, you know, in this country, which is either, you know, financing for retail clients, banking services. But actually, why I am in the commercial bank is financing the broader UK infrastructure, the broader UK transport, and being very, very targeted, very focused, and somehow I would say very simple with what we do. And for us, it's UK infrastructure financing.
Yes. And tell you what I wanted to ask you about. I'm seeing quite a lot now, this bundling together of infrastructure and power by the hour, if you like. Now, it hasn't worked out terribly well for Rolls-Royce, but for road vehicles, it's now possible, isn't it, for you to you or the finance sector to bundle together the charging infrastructure, the energy itself, and the vehicles. Do you think this is going to be the real model for the future?
It is just starting, and I think we'll probably see a lot of changes, and there will be a lot of people, you know, including myself, my peers, you know, a number of experts in the industry, you know, making big statements, and then 6 months, a year later, we realize that we're completely wrong. But I think there is a fundamental change that is probably operating right now. And what I think going to change in particular is the way that you know, we were separating, you know, vehicles from, you know, charging from the infrastructure. And I think the future is probably going to be looking at transport as a whole, not only the infrastructure, i.e. the road, but actually also the vehicle itself, whether it is a bus or truck or obviously the, you know, the cars, and how it is actually managed in a hopefully, you know, in a smart way across the entire road infrastructure. And there is obviously the batteries, you know, for electric vehicles, that is going to be a component, a key component of that. So I really think that as we will go into the 2020s, there will be that whole infrastructure transport concept that will take the lead. Now, I say that, and I will be wrong, of course, because infrastructure is, and in particular in terms of transport, is going to change a lot. But that's would be my bet and my guess today.
And this is driven, isn't it? Because the infrastructure for charging, whether it's electric or indeed filling with hydrogen, is phenomenally expensive compared with what we used to do for diesel. So I think for a hydrogen filling station on your premises, you're looking at £2.5 million and probably something else for electric. The charging infrastructure itself is very capital intensive, isn't it?
And that's why, you know, to be honest, it is not yet a bankable proposition for you know, the banking industry. And what I mean by bankable, indeed, the ability to debt finance it with bank debt. We spend a lot of time as a team on batteries and chargers and the border, you know, infrastructure. And we have been spending a lot of time on it probably for now a good 5 years. But so far, you know, so far it has been a lot of long and very interesting and intellectually challenging brainstorming sessions, but not yet with a concrete proposal on how to finance it. And there have been a couple of projects that probably were close. We thought we were close to have a financing or debt financing solutions, but in the end they went equity only. So I think we are probably a couple of years, if not more, before there's a proper bankable proposition for battery chargers. And the fact that, you know, technology is still evolving and changing, that makes it difficult for us as a banker. The concept of proven technology is very important. What we want in infrastructure, what we want in project finance is it's boring, it's stable, it's predictability. And that's not something we have yet with batteries and chargers.
Finance is interesting like that, isn't it? As you say, entities looking for boring, predictable and solid. But then there's phenomenal amounts of speculative money going into all sorts of other odd things that probably stand no chance of making a return at all. I'm always fascinated by how there's a sort of there's an adventurous end of finance and there's a dull end of finance. And you seem to be able to get enormous amounts of money for some things, yet struggle to put something that's frankly some bricks and mortar, some energy and some assets together. So do you find that yeah, frustrating as well?
Yeah. Now, in the end, what we are probably going to provide as, you know, as banks is a relatively low cost of funding on the debt side for actually assets that can have potentially some substantial leverage. And when you look at, you know, how much leverage those assets can have and the cost actually that we charge, it is very attractive, and the reason for this attractiveness, our willingness to provide it, is indeed that a very long term stability and very low default rates and expected loss that we have on those assets, and that's why it's getting interesting, because with the borders of you know, infrastructure and leverage finance and other asset classes being probably less clear, you know, what we often see is the requirement or the ask, I should say, to finance an asset, which someone may call it or classify it as infrastructure, with probably much less stability than our core book or our core asset or the way we define infrastructure, and which I would probably see more as, put it, you know, leverage finance or venture finance. But I guess they try to badge it as infrastructure because they want to draw the price of infrastructure. So I guess it's, you know, you really need both. And for us, you know, that point of that proven technology and history and track record is going to remain important. And that's probably why we need somehow the help and the support of the governments in terms of potentially revenue stability or revenue predictability to be able to incentivize not only the provider of debts in infrastructure, but also the providers of equity in infrastructure.
And so, I mean, the way I see it at the minute, the government is saying plenty of warm words about what it wants for the recovery of the UK economy, for the investment in infrastructure. And it, and governments, UK governments, like big infrastructure projects, don't they? Because they're headline news, they employ lots of people, somebody gets to cut the ribbon and so on. So, I mean, does that translate through into support? Because they're certainly in the headlines saying we're in favour of all of this. Does it actually translate into real support in your experience?
You know, we see and we can observe every day concrete actions, concrete support, you know, from the government, for infrastructure. I mean, clearly, you know, there is there are different drivers on the government side, which we do understand, but there is a very strong willingness, I would say, from the governments and the different departments to engage with all the partners and including us as a bank. And I would probably say that we have more engagement with the different government bodies and have had in the last 24 months than we had 2 years ago, and 2 years ago versus 5 years ago. So there is, I think there's definitely a willingness to engage with all, you know, the relevant parties and stakeholders across infrastructure in the UK. And as always, the beauty of infrastructure is that it's amazingly visible. So it's easy to explain anyone, you know, like my kids, what I'm doing, which I really love, because it is concrete, put it simply. But because it is concrete, some people will not like it. And it's impossible, therefore, to have a full consensus on what we want or what we don't want, because you always have some people who will not like it for good reasons. And therefore, striking that balance, which is somehow the role of the government, is a very difficult one.
I do remember a long time ago, it was said that as far as Crossrail was concerned, that it suited the government better to have a Crossrail project and not build it, because on that basis, you just kept a few people employed doing plans and projects and so on, 50% of which came back to the Treasury anyway in the form of income tax, national insurance and VAT, rather than build it, because it was much more lucrative for them to have it as a plan but not actually build it. Because, as you know, it is well underway now. But I was always amused by that. But now it seems the message is different. The message is that it wants big infrastructure projects. I'll tell you what does trouble me a bit. Lots of our infrastructure projects on road or on rail have been driven by the belief there was infinite demand. You know, that if you built more capacity, more people would travel. And the more people traveled, then the economy would be better and so on. But just before we got to the pandemic, there were signs that that infinite suppressed demand wasn't really there. So before we got to the pandemic, already the working from home, already the online shopping, already that sort of stuff was starting to have an effect. And ridership that had been growing strongly on road and rail for a long time was just starting to come off. But then we got to the pandemic, and of course, it's completely collapsed. And so nobody's talking anymore about the third runway at Heathrow. I doubt if we'd get HS2 away if we were trying to get it away in the current climate, because the notion that we needed more capacity seems to have gone. So what do you think about that? Does that spoil the prospect for infrastructure?
Well, I think that's a good question. That's actually a very good question. And just before I come into that one, keen to just make a comment, an observation, because you mentioned the government is keen on big infrastructure. I would say my personal opinion is that government is keen on infrastructure. Now we talk, or the press is obviously talking more about the big projects for, you know, the reasons we just talked about, i.e. they are even more visible, so therefore they are probably a bit more controversial somehow, for, again, good and bad reasons. But I would say that, you know, government has been very supportive and keeps supporting, you know, infrastructure in general. What's going to happen in terms of the big projects, you know, next year and the years after next? Well, God knows. We shall see. I would say, however, that the mega trends are likely to come back. It may take indeed 2, 3, 4 years for Heathrow or Gatwick to come back to the pre-COVID-19 traffic level, but it is likely, if not very likely, that it will come back. And if you look at the mega trends, over the next 20, 30 years, demands for traveling, demands for transport is going to continue to grow simply by the fact that the population is going to grow, as well. So we cannot exclude, you're right, a complete and a massive transformation of society where we all move into, teletransportation. And then indeed, yes, all bets off. But there is probably another, 50 or 100 years before we get there. Teletransportation. In the meantime, I think we'll go back to those mega trends. Now, infrastructure is adjusting. And if you think about what's keeping us busy, probably 6, 7 years ago, renewables was a tiny portion of our infrastructure business. We're not talking about broadband at all, or at least in terms of financing it through project finance. So it was PFI. It was PFI, 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 and maybe, maybe a bit of airport and ports, but probably 80 or 90% of our business 7 years ago was PFI. You look at it now, and probably, a third of our time is spent on a digital infrastructure, so broadband. Another third is renewables. And for us, it's mainly large offshore wind. And then the last third is going to be spread among, the rest. And that will be, trains, roads, ports, airports. But that moved from probably a good 80, 90% to only a third currently. So we see a bit of a shift. And I think digital infrastructure is going to be even more or growing in importance in the years to come. Is it going to replace the need for HS2? I don't know. Is it going to replace the need for a third runway at Heathrow? I don't know. Probably in the short term, yes. But in 2030, I'm not sure.
So I had as a guest on this program Professor David Begg, and he's a notable transport academic. And he said he thought we'd all become mobility junkies and that we were confusing traveling for productivity. And he thought that we would learn from this. So we've all done it, haven't we? We've traveled long distances to do a 2-hour meeting and then travel all the way back. Felt exhausted, felt satisfied that we'd worked very hard that day, but in fact, we'd done a couple of hours. I think what you're saying is that we've got this inbuilt desire, if you like. We quite like traveling because we like seeing people and seeing the actual work that's being done, and we're creative and so on. So that sooner or later, that and the growth in population will get us back into the sorts of passenger volumes that we used to see.
Would be my bets. And I'm ready to take it now. Now I lost a number of bets in the past, but I don't know. I think this one, I'm not sure I would lose it. Human being is a social beast,
sure.
And I think, there will be. And I'm not an expert at all. And there will be plenty of amazing lessons, studies on people, teams, productivity, how we can all act, interact, engage with each other, and work remotely and virtually. I believe indeed that things will change. I believe indeed that we're not going to go back to the good old days, in 2021 or 2022. But I also note that some friends who are living in other countries where actually probably the commutes is less an issue because that's smaller cities. And I think that's one of the big difference we have probably with UK or England in general and London in particular. And you think about Geneva, which is where I'm coming from, it's a village. And people commute probably 30 minutes max. You know, if you do more than 15 minutes of commute, you're not happy. You think it's a long commute. And you see, in Geneva, when people were able to go back to work because we were working, but working from home, where they've been able to go back to the office, actually most and probably 80 or 90% of the people in Geneva have been keen to come back, because actually the commute is not an issue. So it will be, I think, different solutions for different cities, for different countries. And I agree that commutes and commuting an hour and a half, 2 hours one way, is not something that is efficient for anyone. And that's something that needs, and that is actually revisited with the pandemic. But still, those people will want to have some social interaction with their teams, with their peers, with their competitors, with their clients, you know, one way or the other. Mm-hmm. So exactly how it's going to be done, we'll see. But we are social beasts.
Yeah, we are. We are. I don't know about you. I used to find that if I had weeks with not enough traveling in them, I didn't get my reading done, because airplane journeys and train journeys are just ideal for catching up on that reading that if you try and do in office time, you just get interrupted.
You're right. And I completely agree with that. I mean, I have it's a 30 minutes journey in the tube. And I come very early to the office. So the tube is and was actually completely empty before the pandemic when I was taking it. So I was doing two things. One was reading the FT for 20 minutes. And two, I was using an app called Headspace, which is basically a bit of a meditation, which you may find weird to do in the tube, but actually the tube is empty. There is no noise except the noise of the tube, and that's somehow relaxing. Sounds a bit weird, I agree. But I was doing those two things, which actually I don't do anymore. And I read less paper than I used to when I was doing a bit of commute. So, yes, I agree with that.
So what's the Lloyd's policy on the return to office? Is there a point at which you expect everybody to be back in their offices like it used to be, or are you expecting a different model for staff?
I think we'll have a different model. For now, everyone is working from home, at least in the commercial bank, for those colleagues who can work from home. So that's obviously different for, you know, retail and the branches. I've been working from home since March, the same for the entire team across infrastructure and transport. Now, we have in different parts of the commercial banks, some colleagues in the bank, traders, for example, and they do some rotations. But for the large majority of the commercial bank, we are all working from home. We are going to work from home until spring, at least. And then we are working on a number of experiments for the new model. And the new model, well, there will be a new model. And that's not going to be, let's go back to the office as we were. And I think the challenge for us, and the same for probably every single employer, is to try to take advantage of the best of both, the working from home and that social and physical interaction we have with colleagues. And that we'll be having that mix of office attendance and work from home.
I'm sure you're right. So, Guillaume, something else I must raise with you. So I often try and think what the listeners are thinking while we're talking. So in my head at the moment, I've got thousands and thousands of whispers. Those whispers are from all the people who would love to be in this conversation with us today, but in fact are going to be hearing this in a week or two's time. So they're all saying to me, you've got this super senior person from one of the major banks absolutely with you for lunch. When are you going to ask him about the consequences of a no-deal Brexit?
I knew there was a trick, because you started by flattering me, by calling me super senior. So I knew there was a trick for us as a bank to get ready to support our clients as much as we can. There's obviously a lot of work that is done by all our clients. That will be a change, a big change. And change means adjustments. I am Swiss. I'm not French. So I'm gonna remain neutral on the topic, as every good Swiss citizen would.
No, you can. Of course you can. Quite right. One other piece of experience, of course, with Switzerland, because Switzerland itself has had a different relationship with the EU, despite being a European country. So we should have some experience, I would have thought, with our trading with Switzerland that will be of value to us.
Yeah, and actually, I think Switzerland was probably the, if not the first, the second country to have a trade agreement ready to be signed with the UK. So that proves, you know, the efficiency of the UK and Switzerland. And when two countries want to put something together, they can do that quickly and efficiently.
So look, our time is nearly up, and we've had a fascinating run through infrastructure and the effects of COVID. And just a last thought, which is, of course, that the economy is running thanks to some very low interest rates. And we've had very low interest rates for a very long time. But I wonder if you have a view as to when we come to paying all this back, we're going to be into quite a tricky economic position where the government, on the one hand, will want to keep interest rates low and it'll want to keep taxes low in order to stimulate the economy. But frankly, we'll have to make quite a bit of money in order to service the huge debt that the country's run. Have you got a view?
I would say, and to link it probably back to infrastructure, it is likely that rates will remain indeed very low for, you know, some time, but not forever. And there is a risk that, you know, at some point in the future, rates will be much higher. And as a result, you know, there is now still an opportunity to finance infrastructure at a very low cost of debt. And I think that's an opportunity and an advantage we need to take, you know, take forward. And I guess whether it is from an equity point of view, but obviously, you know, debt point of view, as we're talking about some zero rates or almost negative rates and maybe future negative rates, you know, I think government should be encouraged to deploy capital and more capital into infrastructure and finance it with debt whilst, you know, it is close to cost nothing or, you know, very low to raise debt, which may change in the future. And the proposal will be very different when, you know, you have or if you have to finance infrastructure cost of, 1 or 2% for long-term money or 5 or 6 or 7%. And that may happen again. Probably not immediately, but that may happen again. So I think we should take advantage of it now.
So there is a very optimistic place to leave, isn't it? Which is that it's hoped that interest rates will stay low for a reasonable period of time. And so there can be no better time to think about infrastructure projects and the financing of them, because we can rely on the cost of servicing quite low for a reasonable length of time. So I think that's a really optimistic place to end, because that helps us, I think, make the economy feel that it should be optimistic. And this is a good time to do some good things with all the benefits that come with it, including the benefits of the capacity that the infrastructure gives you, the employment opportunities, the skills, all of the opportunities for young people and so on. So I've been really glad to have my lunch today with Guillaume Flaherty, who is the Managing Director and Head of Infrastructure, Transport, Manufacturing and Europe at Lloyds Bank. You've already heard us say that we're going to have a proper private drink when the rules allow it, but it's been really good to share this with everybody today at Lunch with Leon, which is an itthub.net production. Please go across to the website. You can check out details of this podcast, how to subscribe, and all the other information on our news channel. For the avoidance of doubt, I am not licensed to give financial advice, and the value of your investments may well go down as well as up. You should consult your own licensed, legitimate financial advisor. But despite that, we've had a really good talk today through a number of the issues, particularly relating to infrastructure and the exciting opportunities that are coming with us. Guillaume, thanks very much indeed for joining us today.
Thank you. That was a pleasure to speak with you.